to Lookahead Radio and viewpoints around the world. My name is Tom Arms, and in a moment I'll be joined by Lockwood Phillips. We get together once a week to discuss world affairs. This week we had a lot to discuss: mounting British political problems, mounting problems in Syria, and mounting problems in and with North Korea. Hope you enjoy listening. Thanks very much indeed.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world. This afternoon, we're joined by Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and, of course, Look Ahead Radio. And with that, Tom, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to be with us. And as we begin the program, just a quick note, how's the weather there in the United Kingdom, there in London?
It's hot. It's in the 90s. It's the hottest it's been since the heat wave of 1979. Everyone is wilting. They're all moaning and complaining.
But we didn't have global warming in 79. I wonder why. No, we won't go there. I just had to bring that up. All right. So the temperature is hot. Is this unseasonable for you?
It warms up this time of year, but it's not usually as hot as it is now.
Okay. Well, we're...
Normally you get temperatures in the 70s and 80s. Now it's in the high 80s and low 90s.
All right. Well, we're having a heat wave here in certain areas of the States as well. Tom, I want to move on to several hot items, as a matter of fact, pardon the pun. One, let's talk about the Queen's birthday. I think she had a birthday party this week and also a public event. Tell us what's going on there with the royal family and what have you learned?
Well, it's a official birthday.
Right.
She has two birthdays every year. One is her actual birthday in April, and then is official birthday. And I think it's actually on Saturday, and they have the trooping of the color, and she watches from a balcony and everything else. So it's a big event. It's when they hand out the latest round of titles and knighthoods and things like that. Today was the Queen's speech, mm-hmm. which is the closest they have to the State of the Union address. And the Queen actually goes around to Parliament. She goes into the House of Lords, sits on her throne, and reads a speech which is written for her by the government. And it's basically setting out the government's plans for the coming parliamentary period. Now, there's several things that are important here. And one is that there isn't going to be one next year. They've decided not to have one. They're just going to carry on and make it a two-year parliament, because there's so much work related to Brexit. Another thing is, she didn't wear her crown today, and she didn't arrive in her state coach. She arrived by car, and she wore a rather fetching blue hat.
You said that there will be no parliament? What do you mean?
No, I said there'll be no Queen's speech next year. They give a State of the Union, effective State of the Union, every year. But it takes time to prepare for the State of the Union address, to work out all the legislation. There is so much legislation related to Brexit that it will take over 1 year to get through it all. And so they're just going to carry on through.
That is important. And we'll get back to that a little later on, because we're going to chat about Brexit. Okay, I apologize. You were giving us the three points of concern. One, of course, the fact that this will be the last Queen's speech or State of the Union speech from her Royal Highness. You said she did not wear her crown. I'm wondering, is that something that it might be an indicative of something else, such as?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't know why.
Okay.
That is, to be honest, I'll have to express ignorance.
And then you
but
said.
But the final thing is that conspicuous by its absence from the Queen's speech was any mention of President Trump's state visit,
which is
very controversial here.
It
would be mentioned in the Queen's speech, and a visit by the King and Queen of Spain was mentioned.
So
there is very, very strong speculation that the visit by President Trump has been canceled or postponed at the very least.
Now, I'm questioning, before we go further, is normally state visits announced by the Queen? Is this a normal procedure historically?
No, it's usually announced by the government and Buckingham Palace, because the person coming for a state visit is organized by the government, but announced by Buckingham Palace, because the person coming is coming as a guest of the Queen, not as a guest of the government.
Oh, that's interesting. So there's
a difference. They get to stay in Buckingham Palace. They have breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, they do a B&B at Buck House, as they say.
Yes, that's a nice B&B, bread and breakfast. All right, let's talk here for a moment, Tom. Is this, do you think, a reaction from the Queen, or is it a reaction from the government, a combination thereof? And could it also be because, and I want to, this does segue beautifully into the relationship with Prime Minister Theresa May and Parliament. So what do you, and again, this is speculative, but what do you glean from this absence of an announced visit by President Trump?
Oh, it's definitely based on that segue you mentioned. And that is, there is no support from any political parties except the Conservative Party. And even that is reluctant. There's strong support from Theresa May, but there's no support from any other political parties for a state visit by President Trump. He is highly unpopular. The only reason he was invited was because Theresa May invited him. She now has lost considerable power and considerable influence. And this is one of those symbolic things which she could drop. And it would not help her, but it wouldn't be a contentious issue. One of those contentious issues which she can drop without causing too much harm to her legislative program.
Well, then let's talk about that legislative program and Theresa May. And of course, we're still hearing some concerns that she might yet lose her position as prime minister. How secure is that? I saw a story recently that demanded from, I guess, the Conservative Party that she initiate a hard Brexit. First question has to do with her relationship with Parliament and within her own party. And the second question is, please define a hard Brexit. But first, what's the status between her and her own party and the rest of Parliament?
Well, she's not popular with her own party. She's not popular at all. She lost 23 seats of members of Parliament, all of whom, you know, they were their friends. And now they're unemployed. And she went into it saying, we're going to have more seats. You're going to have more friends sitting here on the green benches with you in the House of Commons. And so she fed them a load of bull, and it's having repercussions. She's now saying that she will lead with humility and resolve.
Okay.
Now, does this mean that Conservative Party, who are not known for being nice to failed leaders, does it mean that they will jettison Mrs. May? Well, not necessarily. They would jettison her in a flash if she was not in government, if she had lost the completely and wasn't able to form a government. They would get rid of her so quickly, you wouldn't be able to blink your eyes fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
But they need her. They need her there because the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn is gathering momentum and coming up quickly. So they have to close ranks behind her to keep her in power long enough to work out a plan of attack on Corbyn's policies.
But now, the other question, of course, has to do with this issue of Brexit and hard Brexit. What exactly, as I understand it, she can remain in her position if she pursues a hard Brexit. What exactly is a hard Brexit?
Well, a hard Brexit would be withdrawing from what's called the single market and the customs union. Now, that means basically, you know, withdrawing from a free trade agreement with Europe.
Okay.
And jettisoning various things that the Europeans would insist on as a price for a free trade agreement. Now, if they withdraw from the single, if they stay in the single market, which is called the Norway model, because that's what Norway does, they would have to accept EU nationals living and working in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
They would also have to accept EU regulations. They would also have to accept a lot of EU control over trade agreements. And a lot of people say, well, if we have to accept that, Why are we withdrawing? In fact, the only thing they wouldn't get, really, they wouldn't be allowed to sit on the councils where the decisions are made. They would have no representation in Brussels.
Okay.
So, but they would have to abide by the rules of Brussels.
So, in essence, it's a matter of not a an exit from the EU or a Brexit light. It has to be a full exit. Real quickly, before we go to the break, Tom, how secure is that plan in right now in Great Britain? How secure is this?
It's really up in the air. Certainly, the negotiations started on Monday. First round definitely went to the EU. The British had said that they wanted to have trade negotiations at the same time as they discussed what they call the divorce settlement.
Mm-hmm.
It was sequentialism versus parallelism, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right from the start, you know, without any opposition from the British at all, the British simply caved in. And after saying this was going to be the row of the summer, they caved in and said, yeah, we agree with the EU negotiators. We're not going to try and talk about trade negotiations and future trading relationships until we've sorted out the terms of the divorce.
All right. We're going to get back to this in just a moment with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And of course, you're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
This is Tom Arms with the expanded LookAheadNews.com world analysis for the week beginning the 26th of June. Look Ahead broadcasts tomorrow's news today so that you can plan to participate. Torture and its victims will be spotlighted on Monday at an international conference in London to mark UN International Day for Victims of Torture. The keynote speaker will be the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Donald Trump will doubtless raise the issue of North Korean torture when he meets South Korea's newly elected President Moon at the White House on Wednesday. The two men will also discuss economic cooperation, North Korea's nuclear threats, and President Moon's concerns about America basing its terminal high-altitude defense missiles in South Korea. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi also meets Trump next week. While he's in the White House on Monday, demonstrators will be outside the gates demanding that President Trump continue issuing visas to skilled Indians working for high-tech American companies. Impeachment cannot be far from the mind of President Trump these days. On Sunday, anti-Trump protesters across America will stage impeachment marches demanding that the House of Representatives impeach the president on the grounds of treason, obstruction of justice, libel, slander, and violation of the constitutional clauses relating to free speech and equal protection. Liberia's former First Lady, Agnes Reeves Taylor, the ex-wife of former Liberian President Charles Taylor, appears at London's Westminster Magistrates Court on Friday on torture charges. Her former husband is serving a 50-year prison sentence for terror, murder, and rape. In Paris, the newly elected French National Assembly holds its first session on Tuesday. Out of the 577 parliamentarians, a record 424 are new to the job. More than a third of the seats are held by women, and the average age has dropped significantly after the election in which President Emmanuel Macron's En Marche party won a massive majority. In Geneva on Wednesday, Cyprus peace talks resume after they stalled in May over security issues. At the talks will be Turkish Cypriot leader Mustafa Akinci and the Greek Cypriot leader Nikos Anastasiadis. Cyprus was split in 1974 when Turkey invaded the island after a Greek-inspired coup. Negotiations start on Monday in Romania on the formation of a new government, after the government there was toppled by a vote of no confidence. The funeral of former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl is held on Saturday. It will be the European Union's first ever state funeral. Speakers include German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and former U.S. President Bill Clinton. Prince Charles visits Canada next week to help Canadians celebrate Canada Day on the 1st of July. This year's celebrations mark the 150th year since Canada achieved self-government. And that was next week's news today so that you can plan to participate in the world around you. Stay tuned for Viewpoints Around the World with myself and Lockwood Phillips.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. We are joined, of course, by Tom a little early today, so this portion has been pre-recorded. Tom, let's talk about this issue of the Brexit and also the impact of accepting EU nationals, and of course, basically, we're saying a free transit for other nationals or other countrymen or citizens of other countries, if the if it were an British exit light or Brexit light. Obviously, that is of concern, and it brings up the topic of the recent attacks in the UK, and of course, now just recently, an attack at a British mosque. What is the home rule feeling there in Great Britain, particularly in London? And we can bring up the issue of Grenfell Towers, the recent fire there that, as a matter of fact, happened last week. I think the same day as our program initiated every Wednesday, of course, here on the talk station. What is the feeling there in London and the United Kingdom related to the international community as it currently exists?
In London, people were very accepting of the international community. I think where you find the most prejudiced against immigrants is outside of the big urban areas. Mm-hmm. They have no experience of living with people from different cultures. I always tell the story about how my wife and I were visiting some friends in the West Country, about 300 miles from London. Now, she still has her American accent, and she was in one aisle and I was in another. And she shouted out, "Tom, where are the strawberries?" with her New York accent, slight New York accent. Mm-hmm. And you could have heard a pin drop in the supermarket. I mean, everybody stopped. Huh. People came and looked down the aisle at her. Okay. There's a foreigner amongst us.
All right.
In London, you don't bat an eye if you hear French, German,
right,
Bengali, whatever.
Well, okay. So is that the attack on the mosque London here recently? Is this an indication that there's still a great deal of discomfort and distrust, particularly with certain ethnic groups?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, there are far right extremists who are just as dangerous as the jihadists. And this was a far right extremist attacking Muslims who drove his car at a crowd of Muslims shouting, "I want to kill Muslims."
Right. Here's the question. Is that, granted, there are extremes on either case, how is that story being reported particularly in London? Is it basically critical of, for example, the police? There is criticism of that. I want to segue over to the issue of security, and this also applies to Grenfell Towers. What exactly is the feeling there in particularly London, but Great Britain, about security in that country?
If there's criticism, it's criticism of the government, not the security people. And there has been austerity cuts in this country ever since 2010. Now, you know, mentioning Grenfell Towers, that is responsibility of local government.
Mm-hmm.
And funding to local government has been cut by 40% since 2010. And so when they put up things like cladding or decide not to put up things like a sprinkler system, it's because they don't have the money, because the money has been cut from the central government grants.
It's as simple as that. They had
to make hard decisions, and this is the price they pay. And as for security, most of the intelligence work has been on jihadists. Now, they have not paid, as for political reasons, probably as much as anything else, as much attention to the extreme right. And this is one of the results of that, is what they're saying.
Here's a quick question.
They're now going to have to pay attention to the extreme right, as well as the extreme left,
but Tom,
and the jihadist, and everyone else, because basically people are moving to extremes.
All right, Tom.
Not just here in Britain, but everywhere else.
Tom, I understand that, and I don't want to focus on that. I want to focus instead really on the issue of the topic of finances. And we've got just a few minutes before we go to the next break. Are you telling me that, for example, the city of London, which is actually made up of many cities, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't yes. have its own taxing authority and can't afford to provide services? Is this all dependent upon centralized government in the United Kingdom?
No.
Okay.
No, it does have its own taxing authority.
Okay.
Its property rates.
Okay, but what about that relationship?
Tax. But it does. It's not able to raise enough money from property. It also gets grants from central government.
Okay, I find that, well, this is something that we don't quite understand. Because when we hold local communities accountable, they're accountable based on their dollar, not the federal dollar. But that's just how we see it here in the States. All right, Tom, I want to stick with this issue of political unrest right now. And before we go to this next break, and there's a story here I'm looking at related to a statue of Theresa May and hand signs on Dover Cliffs. And of course, Dover Cliffs is a scene of we all see of England. What is going on here?
Right on the cliffs, right about 100 meters away from the edge of the cliffs, facing towards Calais in France, they have quickly constructed a using scaffolding and pictures of Theresa May's face and everything else, draping her in a Union Jack skirt and dress. A Theresa May statue, which is, it looks like it's about 150 feet tall.
Wow.
So it can be seen in Calais, which is 27 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And she has her hand up and she's making a rude sign towards the French.
Why? I mean, what was the purpose of this?
Basically, it was put up there for the start of the Brexit negotiations on Monday.
Oh, okay. All right.
Not a government thing.
You know, it is interesting. Theresa May is, and of course, you mentioned the recent election and the surprise close vote with Jeremy Corbyn of the Liberal Party. It is interesting, Theresa May
Labor
and
Party.
Pardon me?
Of the Labor Party.
Labor Party. I apologize. Yeah, it is interesting to me that she is being held accountable for the events that we would say here in the States are really the responsibility of local authorities. To understand the United Kingdom or the English government and its political interactions, it is the fact that centralized government is seen as a prime provider of services in the United Kingdom. Am I seeing this correctly?
Yes, no. First of all, you have to remember that it's a much smaller country.
Well,
so, you know, it's the size of California,
right,
for a start. So there is probably going to be more involvement by central government, given the fact that, you know, the country is so much smaller, which allows more involvement by central government.
Okay.
Central government would help to set a lot of the major policies. It would also help with the funding. The implementation would be the responsibility okay. of the local authorities,
okay.
how that money is spent.
All right. I just was curious. This is something that's unique, of course, to the parliamentary procedure there in the United Kingdom.
Can I just add,
very
where
quickly?
Grenfell Towers was,
uh-huh.
was in a Conservative-controlled council area, Kensington and Chelsea.
Okay.
So that was another factor against Mrs. May.
All right.
She's Conservative. The local council was Conservative.
Very interesting. All right, Tom Arms, of course, with us this afternoon. This portion has been pre-recorded to accommodate his sleeping schedule, which is midnight as it is airing here on the talk station. Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
View- points around the world with Tom Arms of Look Ahead Radio and lookaheadnews.com, our guest this afternoon. And also to remind you, you can get tomorrow's news today by simply logging on to lookaheadnews.com. No charge, free opportunity. Take advantage of this. And of course, Look Ahead Radio, heard every Friday afternoon here on the Talk Station and on radio stations around the world, literally as well as figuratively. Tom, let's just wrap this up with your home office here, or your home community of Great Britain, United Kingdom, very quickly on the issue of Barclays Bank. And this will get us into the issue of fraud with Qatar, or in some areas we call it Qatar, but Qatar. What's going on with Barclays Bank and the Middle East, for all intents and purposes?
Well, let's preface everything with the word alleged.
Okay.
Four directors, including the former chief executive, a chap called Sir John Farley, have been charged with fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this goes back to the 2008 banking crisis. And I should also say that Barclays Bank is the 18th largest bank in the world,
mm-hmm.
with more than $1.5 trillion in assets. So, you know, if this bank is damaged by this case, it's going to have repercussions.
Oh.
Now, what is alleged to have happened is that Barclays did not want to be taken over by the government, as some of the other British banks were when they ran into difficulties back in 2008. They wanted to retain their freedom. So it is alleged that they went to the Qataris and did a deal with them. And the deal was that they would loan the Qataris $5 billion,
mm-hmm.
$4 or $5 billion, which they would loan to Qataris, and the Qataris would immediately loan back
okay.
$15 billion.
Right. So what's the status of this right now? Is it
well, that's against the law.
Right. No, but what's the status of this case? I want to move on to a few other items.
On the 3rd of July, the four directors are appearing in court to be okay. formally charged.
Wow. All right. We'll pay attention to this. And of course, this has, as you said a moment ago, some significant financial impact on the United Kingdom, especially considering the size of Barclays Bank. Since we're talking about the Middle East, I want to talk first very quickly. New crown prince for Saudi Arabia. What is the status on this? This is just now beginning to see news. How important is this?
Well, it's been announced. Now, it's very important. The crown prince, bin Salman, is now... he's 31 years old,
mm-hmm.
and he's replaced the previous one, who was 57, and the king is 81 years old. So for the very first time, when he ascends the throne, you're going to have someone who's probably going to be in his 40s at the very latest. Most time when someone ascends the throne in Saudi Arabia, they're there for, you know, 5-10 years. They're in their 70s or 80s. We're looking at someone who now is going to have a long run. It's a bit like a Supreme Court justice being appointed in his 30s.
Now, there's a big issue here with Saudi Arabia. And, of course, it has to do with the decline in fuel prices and oil and the conflicts associated with OPEC and, other interest. And of course, here in the United States, we've been very successful in fracking and creating new oil reserves. Saudi Arabia has some financial challenges ahead of it. Is that playing any role in the future of leadership?
Yes, it may well have led to this chap's appointment, because okay. about a year ago, he launched something called Vision 2030.
Mm-hmm.
He was the person responsible for the economics of Saudi Arabia. And basically, he said that he was going to sell off some of the shares in Aramco.
Right.
And he was going to take that money and invest it in other assets. I don't know, industrial assets and things like that. He wasn't completely specific. Try and attract industry and things like that to Saudi Arabia so that it is not quite so oil dependent.
Okay,
Saudi Arabia has a huge sovereign wealth fund,
right?
And so it's not really hurting. or the people who live there are not are a long way from suffering.
But in reality, what we're looking at here is a new day in Saudi Arabia under new leadership, and that plays a role in that. All right, I want to move on just a little bit to the east of that and talk about Syria. Now, two issues here, of course, Syria and Russia, and the fact that the United States shot down a Syrian aircraft recently. Russia has threatened to shoot down anything it deems as being, anything other than Russian and Syria. What is going on there? And you have an interesting story about Australia as well. So what's happening in Syria?
Well, basically, they're jockeying for position because the ISIS is not that far from being militarily defeated. Mm. They've been more or less pushed out completely out of Mosul, and they're closing in on the ISIS capital of Raqqa. And so, like at the end of any war, you have this political vacuum, and everyone is rushing in and trying to grab a piece of the action. And that means the Turks, that means the Syrians, that means the Iranians, that means the Russians, that means the Americans. And that's what it is. And it's creating these tensions.
So you see, let me interrupt here. There's an understanding and a vision there in Europe, and particularly the United Kingdom, that the U.S. has interest in Syria in the sense of, taking a position or real estate? Is that the understanding?
They have interest in the structure of the Middle East, because whatever sort of government emerges from Syria is going to have an impact on relations with Israel, relations with the Gulf states and things like that. And, those are all areas of extreme importance to the United States.
But what's the future of Syria as it is under its current leadership, which is quite totalitarian? What can anyone accomplish in Syria at this point?
Well, that's unpredictable. But the fact is that, what is happening is that ISIS has occupied large portions of Syria. They're going to be forced out, and there is going to be a political vacuum.
And Bashar Assad is not going to. You think that this would be a?
We don't know.
Okay.
That's just it. We don't want Assad taking over Raqqa. Don't forget the Kurds.
Right. And of course, you mentioned and Turkey. And of course, Turkey has its own conflicts with the Kurds as well. It's a matter of having a scorecard. I want to move on to something else that I think this is important. We've only got a few moments before we go to our next break. And I want to take on the international issue. And I'm curious as to the coverage here recently of the return of a North Korean prisoner, Mr. Warmbier. I think I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, who came back under, mysterious circumstances and conditions, physically died recently. Has that been covered in the European press and any of the activities in North Korea?
Oh, yes. It's been covered at some length. It's been covered very straight. No one has really expressed an opinion other than the obvious opinion that the North Koreans are horrible people. And that he almost certainly died as a result of the torture that was inflicted on him just for stealing a road sign. I mean, my children's bedrooms are full of road signs and things that they've pinched.
Well, that's the reason why you can't come back to the States, because we're comfortable. We'll probably have to arrest you. Tom Harms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Tom, is there a sense that maybe Europe should be concerned about what's going on in North Korea? As we speak, there is some concern about activity related to one of their nuclear test sites. So I'm just curious, is there there's an awful lot going on in the world politic. And of course, we mentioned Saudi Arabia and Syria, which is a big issue. And we haven't even talked about still the European Union relationship. Is there a feeling that maybe North Korea is on the far side of the globe, sort of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. I mean, yes, they're very concerned. Yes, of course, they're very concerned about the nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. They're very concerned about the human rights issue in North Korea. But at the same time, there's very little that they can do about it. They have very little leverage over the North Koreans.
Right. And that's
the only ones who have leverage over the North Koreans are the Chinese, really.
Right.
And if you like, the only ones who have leverage over the South Koreans are the United States.
Right. So those are the big players in this case. I just wondered how that was being covered. All right, we've got to take a quick break with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're looking forward to wrapping things up with him here on Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from LookAheadNews.com. Politics hates a vacuum. It especially hates a vacuum in the tinderbox cockpit of the Middle East, where the conflicting issues of money, vital resources, religious extremism, religious conflicts, historic rivalries, and the geopolitical link between East and West dangerously clash. The virtual collapse in 2011-2012 of Bashar al-Assad's despotic regime in Syria created such a vacuum. It was filled by the even more despotic Islamic State Caliphate. Now the Caliphate is on its knees. The western half of Mosul was recaptured. Only a handful of IS fighters remain in the dangerously narrow winding streets of the eastern half. The fundamentalists once boasted that their Syrian-Iraqi base would become a springboard from which to launch an Islamic conquest of the Middle East and Europe. They have retreated to their spiritual capital of Raqqa in Syria for the final battle to the death. They will lose, but who will win? And what will they win? Assad, Russia, the U.S. and its Western allies, Iraq, the Kurds, Turkey, Iran, a score or more of rebel forces, all are directly involved in the fighting. Then there are the backers, or, shall we say, interested parties. Saudi Arabia, Israel, Qatar, Kuwait, the EU, the United Arab Emirates, Somalia, Afghanistan, and the wider Islamic world. It looks as if Assad will regain and remain in power for the foreseeable future. But he'll be a political shadow of his former self. Neither the Trump administration nor any of its European or Arab allies have any stomach for removing a secular despot who can be replaced by another fanatic Islamic despot. And besides, he will have the military support of Iran and Russia. Russia and Iran are set to be the big winners. They gambled on Assad when he was all but dead and buried. They can expect payback in the form of military bases, political influence, and lucrative contracts to rebuild a war-torn Syria. This is not good news for the U.S. and its allies. They do not want Russian influence back in the Middle East at a time when Moscow is also flexing its muscles in the Baltic and Ukraine and hacking into Western computer systems. They especially don't want Iran to extend its regional tentacles. Israel should have special cause for concern. To have Assad on its northeastern border was bad enough. To have an Assad backed by Iran, and presumably with Iranian troops, is the stuff of nightmares. The EU will have mixed feelings. They don't want expanded influence in the Middle East for Russia or Iran, but they would welcome a return to normality which would stem the tsunami of refugees. Then there is Turkey, and of course the Kurds. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan appears to have designs for revived Ottoman greatness. Relations with the EU and NATO have been relegated to the back seat in pursuit of his goal. Erdogan's troops are in northern Syria, and he will want them to stay. Standing in his way are the Turks' traditional betonwar, the Kurds. They've been struggling for a homeland carved out of Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Turkey for more than a century. They've been the boots on the ground for the U.S.-led coalition and expect the reward. The question is, will America be in a position to give it? Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are even more worried about spreading Iranian influence than Washington. Moscow they can live with, but not Tehran. The end of the civil war in Syria would free up battle-hardened Iranian troops for the fighting in Yemen and embolden Tehran to foment discontent among Shiite populations in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. For the rest of the Islamic world, the approaching end of the Syrian civil war eliminates a focal point for their dissident fundamentalist populations. Its removal undermines the jihadist, but also means that thousands of angry, battle-hardened fundamentalists will be returning home, many of them still firm in their warped political religious beliefs. You can destroy a state, but you can't kill an idea. As the end approaches, the players jockey for pole position and the stakes and dangers increase inexorably. Current conflicts are not so much between crazed jihadists and superpowers, but between superpowers keen to retain or regain influence at the other's expense. All sides are aware of the dangers, but the closer we come to the end, the more determined they become to succeed.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And by the way, just to remind you about LookAheadNews.com, tomorrow's news today. Tom, we're going to do a quick run through because I want to get to a topic of interest here related to some folks being found in a Beijing basement. I find this one interesting. But before we do, I'd like to talk to you about a Supreme Court case on gerrymandering. And of course, that's a topic that's pretty important here just in our local audience, North Carolina. Of course, one of the plaintiffs, or if you will, defendants in this case. We've already had two gerrymandering cases heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. And of course, there's a big one in Wisconsin that's underway as we speak. You have a little note here about how the British have set their boundaries up for voters. How have they set their boundaries?
It's done entirely by civil servants. It's not a political thing at all. It's not done by the state or county legislature. It's not done by parliament. They have something called the Boundaries Commission, used to be called the Electoral Commission. And they revise the boundaries every 10 years or so based on changing demographics. It's completely independent. It does require an act of parliament in the sense that parliament has to approve it. And they can, in theory, make amendments to it as it goes through. But nobody, since it was set up in 1944, has dared to make any amendments because they'd be open to the accusations of gerrymandering.
Well, we
so it's very much run by the civil service here.
Here's a quick question for you, Tom. Gerrymandering is a U.S. concept. Why would the British ever worry about
it? Massachusetts.
Right, exactly. 1789, as a matter of fact. I'm just fascinated that the Brits would be even worried about.
Governor Gerry, who constructed electoral districts in the shape of salamanders.
Salamanders, right? Exactly. I just find it fascinating that you have this kind of dispute as to how votes are apportioned in Great Britain. That's interesting. That's something we've never considered. We just recognize this as a U.S. issue. All right. As we wrap it up with you, Tom Arms, of course, of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio, let's talk about a large number of people found living in a Beijing basement. Okay.
Yeah. Well, no windows, nothing. It turned out it was a luxury apartment building, and somebody noticed there were a lot of strange people walking around, and they all seemed to be going through this door in the basement. And there were 400 of them down there. Now, this is a reflection of the housing problems that China has. They've got this huge demand for labor in the cities, and people are migrating from the country to the cities, but they can't house them all. And they estimate that there are at least 1 million people living in the cities in China who are living in basements or subdivided old bomb shelters and things like that. They're called Shuzhu, which means rat tribe. And the rent for one of these basement apartments is $20 a month compared to a normal rent of almost $700 a month. So you can see why they do it.
I can see there's a great opportunity for some entrepreneurs to build houses, and or maybe we've got a situation here in the States. Have you heard about our little houses by any chance?
No.
Oh, they even now have, we're talking 200, 800 square feet. They're called tiny houses or little houses. And we're even now having expositions of people living in these homes. So I see an entrepreneur's future here in China. As always,
we'll
Tom.
We'll tell them to found the Chinese embassy.
We will definitely do that. As always, Tom, thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And as always, to remind you, tomorrow's news today at LookAheadNews.com. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of The Talk Station.